Good morning to you. It's a wonderful experience to be here in Louisville with the this wonderfully welcoming seminary body of faculty and students, these crowds that have come out to hear me speak and to enjoy the music. It's a marvelous place that you have here. When I speak from the pulpit and use a text to speak about creation, I never use the opening verses of Genesis, opening chapters with all their detail of the creation story. I start with the prologue to the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. These, it seems to me, are the crucial verses in the Bible that provide the doctrine of creation, that tell us that the creation was through the Word, that tell us the identity of the Word, that tell us that this Word is the light of men, that is to say, the pathway to true knowing and understanding, and the life of men, the life of all people that we can have if we accept it on God's terms. This is the crucial doctrine of creation. And it is denied by a contrary doctrine that says, in the beginning were the particles. In the beginning was matter in mindless motion. And there is no light. There is no ultimate life. It is all a meaningless whirl of events in which we are left to ourselves to make up our own standards. In fact, one of my friends wrote a paraphrase of the opening words of this gospel in modernist terms, and he wrote it this way. He said, in the beginning were the particles, and the particles became complex living stuff, and the stuff became aware, and the stuff conceived of God. That is what has become the orthodoxy in our society and culture, and when children are taught in schools that evolution is a fact, that is what they are being taught, even though all of the implications of it will not be made true, clear at the beginning. They will be led to believe that we're only talking about harmless little variations in finch beaks or whatever, but they will learn the full implications of that doctrine in due course. Now, I thought I'd tell a bit of the story of that doctrine and of the conflict over it in simply in terms of my life history, which will be, in a sense, some ways your life history too, because we've lived during the same times, some of you not quite as long as I have. I was born in 1940, just before the beginning of the American involvement in World War II, in Aurora, Illinois, in the Chicago area, and raised in a nominal Christian family, a small denomination that eventually merged with the Methodists. We went to church because it was good for children. And on the way to Sunday school, we would drop my father off at the golf course. And this experience left me with a mighty lifelong interest in the game of golf. And a determination that when I got big enough to defy mother, I was going to play golf on Sunday mornings. But I went through that church, through the confirmation class. That was the deal. I had to stay through till I got confirmed at the age of 12. And I probably got more out of it than I realized at the time or can remember now, because I also did have an abiding interest in things religious, in theology. As a junior high schooler, I was an outspoken agnostic, and I regard that kind of agnostic skepticism of the Clarence Darrow, Bertrand Russell type as an ideal philosophy for junior high schoolers. It's like the saying goes, you know, if you weren't a socialist at 20, you have no heart, and if you're still a socialist at 35, you have no mind. I was a very smart kid in school, probably too smart for my own good, and everything came easy for me, and I developed the arrogance and lazy habits that go with that kind of gift. I went away to Harvard as a freshman just after my 17th birthday, not even finishing high school, and I thought that I was leaving behind all of the small town things like Christianity, and that I was going to go into the big time of the real world as I saw it, you see, the world of the Ivy League and Washington and New York, and become some kind of a big shot, which is, after all, what life is all about, isn't it? I also wanted a life of adventure. I set out to hitchhike around the world after I graduated from college, but eventually went to law school because my father wanted me to so much, and I didn't have a good enough reason to refuse. And then I happened to have a high aptitude for that and did awfully well, ended up as a law clerk to the Chief Justice of the United States, I got a professorship at Berkeley, and even married the homecoming queen, which for a kind of nerdy kid was really the summit of my ambition, and came to Berkeley as a professor because I thought it was a wonderful, adventurous sort of place, the lifestyle to be, great climate, and all of that, and with a set of rather shallow values. Now, during this time, I was, as I say, interested in theological things a bit. I was an admirer of C.S. Lewis and Chesterton and that sort of thing. But I had the idea that the time for that had passed. You see, that was for people of another time and place or of another intellectual level or something, that it was not for people like me, although I was not against it, you know, for people who need that sort of thing, that sort of condescending, patronizing attitude that people who think too well of their own minds often tend to have. I often, when I give lectures on the intellectual events of the 20th century, stop and pause for a moment. In a particular year when I was an undergraduate at Harvard on the way to this academic career, the year 1959, which I think is the year, of course, that immediately precedes that period we know as the 60s, and which I regard as a pivotal year, just as 100 years before, 1859 was well known among historians of ideas as a pivotal year, the year that Charles Darwin published his Origin of the Species, Karl Marx published his most important work, Wagner began his spectacular career in the arts, and oil was discovered underground in Pennsylvania, launching the petroleum age, a big year. Well, the centennial of 1859 was a big year, too. A number of important events happened, and I think that the most important of them was the great celebration that was held at the University of Chicago, where I went to law school shortly afterwards, of the centennial of Darwin's great masterpiece, an event which was entirely triumphalist in character and signaled that in the intellectual and cultural world, Darwinism had now become the religion of the entire community. The keynote speaker, Julian Huxley, on that occasion, made no bones about that. He stated quite frankly, that Darwinism now taught us the meaning of life, that it had shown that God was only an illusion, and that this would now be our guide for the future for everyone, whether they liked it or not. And that was the atmosphere in which I came of age, in which, of course, I imbibed a great deal of that kind of thinking, that the hope for humanity lay in science, in social progress, in enlightenment. And if there were problems, there could be social reforms. If there was injustice, you could modify the laws. If you needed resources in something, they could be provided. And this secular, rationalistic kinds of path was the way to improve the world, the way to lead to the only kind of utopia that we could ever have, the only kind of heaven on this earth and in this life through our own efforts. I thought that my generation, as a new generation always thinks, would do much better than those fools who came before us, that we would find parenting, for example, extremely easy and would raise our children to be enlightened, and we felt very confident as we approached the future. Now, in the immediate aftermath of this triumph of the Darwinian and the materialist way of thinking, of course, something immediately happened to God's moral authority. If God is revealed as an illusion, and if our true creator is a mindless material process of evolution, then God's moral authority and the rules that go with it are illusory as well. They are simply the commands of human beings from an earlier time which we're perfectly free to disregard and change. And this happened in many areas, but the most spectacular one was in the nature of marriage. When I grew up as a boy, I didn't know anyone. There was one boy in town whose parents were divorced, and you know, everybody felt terrible about that there should be such a case. And it was very difficult to get divorced, not just because of the law, but because of the social stigma involved. In the 1960s, legal reformers, in fact, one of them, the major voices, a member of my own faculty at the law school I teach at the University of California, succeeded in changing the nature of marriage and the marriage law so that it was just a contract which you could drop at the will of either party at any time. The divorce reforms, as they were called, of the 1960s. And the social stigma went away along with the legal obstacles. The nature of marriage changed, the sexual revolution came, behind the sexual revolution came the feminist revolution and the demand for an unlimited right to abortion, which the courts and the authorities immediately gave. And behind the feminist revolution came the gay rights revolution, all in time. These are not accidental developments. They are logical outcomes of the abandonment of God's moral laws, of a biblical standard of morality, of a growing consensus that it's up to us to make the rules and we can change them at any time. And in fact, we have a great deal of difficulty justifying placing any restrictions on people that prevent them from doing what they want to do, if it's by mutual consent, and if the only victims are uncomplaining ones that we can't hear from, like unborn children. All of this followed logically from the starting point in the perception of reality, and the things unfolded in that order. Now, this affected my personal life as well. As the 60s became the 1970s, the mid and late 1970s, I found myself in a state of growing dissatisfaction and discontent. I had made all of the superficial right moves in the academic career. I had a tenured position at Berkeley and eventually an endowed chair, a couple of textbooks out in criminal law, my specialty, and it was all completely meaningless. All this, and many of us, the best and the brightest, had gone into criminal law among the legal academics. And to show you what a profoundly constructive effect we had, when I came to Berkeley in 1967, the governor, it was Ronald Reagan at that time, by the way, his new governor, there were under 20,000 people in California prisons. Today there are over 140,000. Whatever it was we did in fiddling around with legal rules, it didn't seem to help the crime problem, and in fact, it didn't make a criminal punishment more effective or fair. We seemed to be just playing a game among academics that had no meaning outside of our own field. My marriage, which had been very happy at the start, and we had two children, came under the changes that swept through the society, and particularly the feminist ideology that swept through the academic world. And I I ended up in a day in 1977 with my wife saying that she was going to go off to join an artist's group in another city, and that I was going to be there with the children and take that responsibility. I didn't resist that by that time. It was clear, things were clearly going that way, and I thought it was probably for the best. But I was now at a state in which you can see that I was ready to re-examine a lot of the thinking that had gotten me into that position. That obviously what I had relied on wasn't working. That although it did work at a superficial level, I got what I thought I wanted, it turned out not to be what I thought it was going to be. And so I was at a stage when one can reconsider whether I was as smart as I thought I had been, whether the things you see that I thought were not for me, but only for people who needed that sort of thing, might be exactly for people who needed that sort of thing, like me. So at this moment, the decisive event, the event that I tend to mark the great change in my life, came just at this time of year, the spring break time in school, because my 11-year-old daughter was attending a vacation Bible school invited by a neighbor child who was a Christian. She wanted a parent to go to the final night dinner on the Friday night, where you're supposed to bring a parent for the awards thing and so on. Her mother wouldn't go. Her mother was raised in a very conservative Christian family, Missouri Synod Lutheran, and she was in rebellion against it lifelong, really still is. And she didn't want to have anything to do with the church thing, but I was quite willing to go. And I went that night along with her, we were there at the dinner. And I knew that after the evening was over, when we came home, I was going to have to tell her that her mother was leaving that weekend. We had decided to tell the children that very night. And so I, was in what I would call a state of heightened awareness. I guess that's a term out of the drug culture, but that wasn't the reason in this case, that it was the pressure of all of these events and the emotion. And so I was listening with rather different ears than I might have had at any other time. And I heard the minister tell the gospel as he welcomed the people and give a presentation. And to this day, I cannot remember anything much of the substance of it, but I just remember thinking as I heard it, he really believes that and founds his life on that. I'm quite convinced listening to this. And I could, too. I could, too. Now, if this had been a good Southern Baptist church, you see, there would have been an altar call to take advantage of this moment. But these are Presbyterians, and they're different. We won't go into that. And nothing as dramatic as that happened. But I left with a sense about that, though I didn't come to Christ until some months after that, that the really decisive step is not so much the decision as the moment when the decision becomes a real possibility, you see, instead of an abstract possibility. If you think of it like it, probably none of us here can imagine even as a possibility becoming a Muslim, let's say. It's just not on our mental map. See, but if you reached a stage where that was really an active possibility and you're saying, should I become a Muslim tomorrow or not, you've made a huge step, you see, even though you think of yourself as still undecided. So if you put that as an analogy, that you could say that I was already on my way at that point because of that. And it leads, of course, to something that's been very important in my intellectual life after that, the understanding that it is the preparation of the mind to take something as a real entity and a real possibility that is perhaps the decisive step in getting to the answer, even though you may take that step sometime before you actually make the commitment to the answer. So at that point, I became a Christian. Thereafter, I became fascinated by the question of whether the gospel answers, whether the gospel picture of reality, the picture of reality stated in those opening verses of the gospel of John, is real or an illusion. You see, because the authority figures in our culture tell us that it is an illusion. They tell us that in reality, in the beginning were the particles. And if you think that in the beginning was the Word, you are comforting yourself with an illusion that may actually be comforting, but it isn't real. Or is it? And so my intellectual life has been devoted to examining that question and arguing it and showing that indeed what is the illusion is the set of beliefs that I came to accept out of my background and out of the intellectual currents that were going around that year 1959 as a reality that you could found your life on. I found personally that what I thought was solid rock was in fact quicksand. And I find intellectually that it's quicksand too. And that we can learn to show that. We can learn to show people why what they're putting their feet down on is not solid and will not sustain them. And that is why I have gone into this career of examining the foundations of scientific materialism, of Darwinism. Darwinism is not merely a scientific theory, it is a creation myth, a creation story that makes a certain kind of society. It is preached by a priesthood of an established church. Because, you see, an established church is a church whose priests are paid out of tax money, just taxed from everybody. Very contrary to Baptist tradition, I might say. And that is what it is, and in which the resources of government which we pay for are used to propagandize. Now, it's wonderful to be taking this message to a place whose institutional history shows that ideas can be changed, that a dominant ideology can be replaced, that an effective protest and change can be made. So there is no need to be discouraged by all of this. Particularly when you are arguing for the truth, you have a solid foundation on which to make that change. Now, after a change has been made, it is no time to sit back and congratulate yourself on what has been accomplished in the past. It is a time to think about what can be accomplished from that platform. And what better time to think of what can be accomplished from that platform than the moments as we approach that magic year, 2000, the end of the 20th century, the end of the second millennium of the Christian church. And as we think about what can be accomplished in the coming decade, in the coming century, in the coming millennium. Can we found a genuine intellectual program on that solid rock of in the beginning was the Word? Yes, I believe we can. Can we found a new basis for gradually improving relations among the differing Christian denominations? Yes, I think we can, if we found on that solid rock. Can we learn to pursue Christian objectives with intellectual integrity and good arguments and treat the intellectual world and the universities as a mission field rather than something that we have to retreat from? Well, yes, I think we can do that too. In fact, I see this as really the Great Commission in our immediate future. It is not as if we had a solidly Christian world here in America, and so we send missionaries out to the world to bring them the wonderful things that we have. In fact, this is something we Presbyterians know about. The Koreans are sending missionaries to us. And When we recently had the start of a revolution in our Presbyterian church, nothing as spectacular as what's happened in the Southern Baptist, but you know, at least a little turn in a different direction, and the executive director of the denomination was actually fired because of some horrible retreats from biblical standards that had been going on. The first meeting of the governing council was deliberately held in Korea, you know, where the influence of the Korean Presbyterians would help to steer people onto the right path. So you see, the whole worldwide mission situation is different. In August, I'm going to be going to London. I might attend the Lambeth Conference, where a movement is being made by third world African Episcopal churches to, I don't know exactly what the word is, disfellowship, I think is what Baptists would say, the American Episcopal Church, because it has strayed so far from the common way. So I don't believe it'll actually happen, but it'd be fun to watch if it did. You know, the Great Commission now is to ourselves. The Great Commission is in partnership with, rather than in a teacher-student relationship with these, you know, daughter churches in other countries. And the Great Commission is to call our own culture back to reality, back to a better understanding of the way things really are. And what is the way things really are? Well, in the beginning was the Word. See, and the Word was God, and the Word was God. We are not alone in a meaningless cosmos. We don't have to look for other civilizations to find what we need for our tutelage. We have it available to us in the Word of God, and in what God has done for us. And isn't that an awfully exciting time for seminarians to contemplate when they think of what the future holds for them? I congratulate you all on it, and thank you for coming to hear this message.